With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Indie Football Podcast. I'm joined by sports editor of The Independent, Ben Burrows, and football reporter, Lawrence Osler. And this week we're going to be talking about the Premier League's new managers. Watford, Tottenham, Hotspur, Arsenal, Watford again, Everton and West Ham have all made a managerial change this season. But did those clubs make the right decision? But before all of that, we're going to be talking about the latest transfers. Because, as we all know, transfers are without a doubt the best thing about football. So, since we last recorded, there have been two fairly significant loan deals. Let's start with Crystal Palace, who snapped up Cenk Tosun on loan from Everton. Lawrence, you think that's a good bit of business or a little bit desperate?
No, I think it's a sensible bit of business. Crystal Palace clearly have sort of fallen out of love with Christian Benteke, and it seems like he's about to move on. Cenk Tosun is, I suppose he is a bit like Christian Benteke in the sense that he's on that raft of backup strikers in the bottom half of the Premier League.
Strikers who don't score.
Yeah, and they will come with the tag of needs to revive their career. And perhaps this would be the move for him. I mean, I was having a look at some of his stats earlier and he hasn't had a double figure season for about 5 years. So I don't think he's necessarily the answer. But I don't think they've signed him to start every game. They've signed him to do what he did on the weekend, which was come on after an hour, switch to a 4-4-2 and provide some more attacking threat when their kind of double bank of four hasn't produced enough chances. So I think in that sense, he's just a sensible, logical signing, low risk, sign him until the end of the season and maybe he grabs 3 or 4 goals and helps them out.
Sure. And Ben, Spurs this week signed Gedson Fernandes on loan from Benfica with an option to buy in the summer of 2021. The last highly rated young Portuguese midfielder to make his way to the Premier League was Renato Sanches. But I suppose the structure of this deal makes it as low risk as possible.
It is low risk in terms of sort of initial financial outlay. I think the sort of the tricky one is that it's almost like no win, because if he does really well, then he's going back to Benfica because they'll sell him to somebody else. I don't see Tottenham spending the 56 million I think has been quoted to make it permanent. So sort of it's like they're almost on a hiding to nothing where they're hoping he doesn't do quite as well as maybe they, in a sort of weird way. I'll confess, as I think most of the football watching public don't know a great deal about him, he would appear to be sort of a box-to-box guy in the mould of Lo Celso, really, which is sort of a weird one. They're sort of trying to get a few more bodies in there. I wouldn't immediately say that the centre of the park is the area they really needed to strengthen. Obviously, the injury to Sissoko has left a bit of a hole. Hopefully he can play right back, is all I would say.
I've heard he's just a deluxe Fred, but I don't know if that's true.
It makes me worry about Harry Winks a little bit, because he's quite a lightweight Fernandes, by the looks of him, and I'm not really sure you're going to be getting away with playing both of those and then also Lo Celso.
I mean, it's options, isn't it? So I think Mourinho has always been a manager who wants two players in every position, famously when he was at Chelsea. An extra body in there, maybe someone he knows a bit better than current ones. He's obviously had a little bit of time to have a look at the squad. It is low risk. It's not costing them too much money. So, I mean, worst case scenario, you can send him back. It's not too bad.
Let's stick with Spurs, because they, of course, replaced Maurizio Pochettino with Jose Mourinho in November. Since then, they've played 14 games, won 7, drawn 2, lost 5, which means Mourinho has got a slightly higher Spurs win percentage than Harry Redknapp, but is officially not as good a manager as either David Pleat or Tim Sherwood. Lawrence, 2 months on, do you think any real progress has been made? And I guess more importantly, can you see what Mourinho is trying to do?
To the first question, I'd say there was some progress in perhaps the first 2 games. It seemed to be in terms of the players' energy and effort and pressing, and particularly, I remember the first game being almost like quite impressed by that. That seems to have faded, certainly from where I'm sitting, and I think they've won one of their last 4 Premier League games. I think real tangible progress in the kind of medium term is far less sure. I don't believe he's changed as a man. You know, that was the tale, wasn't it, from the press conference, which I think, as we've heard before, from basically every press conference he's ever done, opening press conference he's ever done. But he hasn't. I don't think he's changed particularly. I don't think his philosophy on football will change much at all. I don't think he's the kind of person who is going to evolve with the times or you know, buckle his pride in order to kind of follow what Guardiola is doing, for example. He's going to keep doing what he's doing, and I don't think it is as effective as it was many, many years ago. And the form that they're in now is very reminiscent of sort of Man United early 18-19 season. You know, it's like it's just very underwhelming. The defeat to Southampton was, I thought, was particularly underwhelming. And particularly in that game where they do have possession, and they're just Tottenham allowed to have possession. And when Mourinho teams are allowed to have possession, they're particularly ineffective. And Southampton played that, I thought, perfectly. So, yeah, I'd be pretty concerned if I was a Tottenham fan about perhaps some stagnation now.
To play devil's advocate a little bit, there was obviously an incredibly negative reaction to the Liverpool match last weekend, which Spurs obviously lost 1-0, and they didn't really bother attempting to kind of play any football until the last 20 minutes when they appeared to have Liverpool on the ropes briefly. Ben, do you think that kind of reaction was overblown a little bit? Because, you know, it's Liverpool, they're the best team in the country. They haven't lost since about 2004. And Spurs very, very nearly got something out of that match.
I think, like Lawrence says, plenty's changed since 2004 and is sort of his absolute peak. But what hasn't changed is that Jose will always be the lightning rod for everything, whether good or bad. So if they have a great game plan that gets you out of jail and does the impossible, then it's all down to Jose. And then if they lose a game they should lose, then it's also Jose's fault. I see sort of both sides of the argument. It's been all over Twitter for a few days. To me, I don't really know what else they could have done. If Lo Celso sticks a chance in that he scores 99 times out of 100, then maybe everyone is talking slightly differently, that he did pull off a result against the best team we've seen in some time with a threadbare squad playing an 18-year-old at right centre-back out of nowhere.
And it's worth noting as well that the biggest grumble so far has been that he hasn't improved the defence, which is quite kind of ironic given the reaction to this performance.
Yeah, precisely. I think it's almost like, what is he supposed to do? It's like, if you go and try and take Liverpool out of your own game, you are going to lose. It's what City famously did in the knockout stages of the Champions League a couple of seasons ago. They tried to fight fire with fire and got burned massively. And Pep, who is the best coach in the world, one of the best coaches in the world, responded to that by playing much more proactively against them the last couple of times and has got results. And he didn't get hammered for playing Laporte at left back and trying to nullify Salah and the things that Mourinho similarly tried to do, and Pep's doing it with much better resources. So I don't really know what else he could have tried to do. Obviously, they weren't the best team on the pitch. Liverpool were, but then that's the same for every team who's played Liverpool this season. So I think you could criticise him for Southampton, the game I watched, and they were very poor in that game. I think that's absolutely fair. What he did against Liverpool, I think, is, I mean, what else are you supposed to do?
I agree with that. I think the Liverpool game almost was a great example of when he's at his best, which is spoiling other people's plans, like you say. And I think the criticism of that performance was a bit over the top. I think Tottenham had more shots than Liverpool had. And like you say, they could have actually equalised. They could have got a point out of that game. But just going back to that point about, you know, people expecting him to improve the defence, he didn't really do that at Manchester United, really. He spent the whole time demanding more centre-backs, and when he bought more centre-backs, they didn't improve the defence at all, and they went down as flops. So I kind of think that's almost a myth, that he is this manager that comes in and stabilises a back four, and that doesn't really happen, as people say it doesn't.
On that point, do you think Tottenham's defence now is much better than that Manchester United defence, because you've got two admittedly quite old but once world-class defenders in Vertonghen and Alderweireld, De Vincent, who looks very talented, Foyt, Tanganga's appeared out of nowhere. So, should he be able to fashion something relatively resolute from that?
Yeah, I suppose he should. That is a good argument. I think it's a better, man for man, it's probably a stronger defence than certainly United.
Let's leave Aurier out of that question.
Yeah, well, I mean, Mourinho didn't really have Wan-Bissaka, so it's slightly, it was probably not as good a defence as he's got now. I suppose the problem he's got now is that the centre-backs, who are the cornerstone of that defence at Spurs, don't necessarily want to be there. So it's a difficult one. He probably doesn't have the protection he wants as well. You know, Sissoko obviously is injured, and that, I suppose, the midfield is lacking a little bit of security, which United had a bit with Matic before he kind of got a bit slow.
The one thing I think he has kind of struck upon, and it's an incredibly wanky phrase for which I apologise, but the asymmetric defence, where he had it against West Ham with Davis sitting deep and Aurier bombing forward on the right, and now it's kind of, you've got Tanganga kind of sitting deeper and Sessegnon kind of bombed up in the FA Cup. Do you think that's something that could kind of work in the Premier League?
I think so. I think you've seen, to go back to Pep again, you've seen him play with literally without a right back before. There's no reason why, just because you put it on a piece of paper, that it has to be a symmetrical formation. If you don't believe you're going to be attacked down one side, then why cover a threat that isn't there? So I don't think there's anything against that. I think to go to the point of the sort of not improving the defence, it sort of feels to me a bit like that defending is the sole job of the defenders is a bit of a myth. And so it's like, oh, Spurs are conceding too many goals, it must be the goalkeeper in the back four's fault. But I don't think that's necessarily true. I think defending is a entire team's job. And if you look at the makeup of his midfield, which he doesn't really know what his best one is, I don't think yet, there isn't much protection for those two centre-backs. They seem to get quite a lot of people running straight at them, which is difficult for any defender, regardless of how good you are. Mm. And I think if you look at, it's a similar problem that you had at Man United, I think, and it's what United are sort of going through now, is that Maguire, they spent a lot of money on a defender who is clearly got lots of ability. But at Leicester, where he made his name, he had a lot of protection from Wilfred Ndidi, doing a lot of the hard work in front of him, so he wasn't getting free runners running straight at him. At United, until latterly, he's had to sort of deal with a turnstile in front of him where he's getting a lot of trouble. It's the same thing that Tony would say if he was here about Dejan Lovren at Liverpool, when so he's obviously the laughingstock and he's not as good as they wanted him to be and all this stuff. But what he would say is that playing next to Alberto Moreno and having Steven Gerrard as your nominal defensive midfielder ahead of you when he wants to be in the 18-yard box makes you very vulnerable as a centre-back. And I think there's sort of, I think there's elements of that. It's not to say that Davinson should make less mistakes and do crazy stuff, or that Vertonghen or Alderweireld should step up and be a bit better. But I think it is quite a sort of a whole team problem.
You can see why Mourinho was so excited to work with Eric Dier, in the sense of his sort of skill set appeals so kind of directly to Mourinho. And we could probably do an entirely separate podcast on all of the problems of Dier, because he's been absolutely abysmal since he returned from injury. Just finally on Spurs, do you think that Mourinho's struggles have essentially vindicated Pochettino? Because Pochettino identified that the squad had a lot of old players. He wasn't able to play Sessegnon and Ndombele all that much because of their injuries. He knew that Eriksen wanted to leave and didn't really want to kind of build a team around him. And these are all just the problems that Mourinho's got now.
There's definitely an element of that. I think it would be too simplistic to just say it wasn't Pochettino's fault. I think the narrative that came out of Pochettino's sacking was that he had kind of his time had come to an end in terms of players were frustrated with the double training sessions, and there was a lot of that coming out of the club at that time. So I think clearly there was problems with Pochettino, and it wasn't just a case of like he wasn't being backed in the transfer market. I think there were fundamental issues with his relationship with the players, and I think that journey had essentially come to an end. It's just that Mourinho hasn't, well, he had an effect for about 2 weeks and it just hasn't sustained it, I think. But yeah, you're right. There's clearly fundamental problems there. Part of that comes down to Daniel Levy perhaps just not, you know, putting his hand in his pocket. And but then the sort of flip side of that is that I think he is one of the best run clubs in the Premier League, partly because of that, because he doesn't just spend wages needlessly. So yeah, there are fundamental issues there. But I think Pochettino had other issues as well.
Okay, hopping across North London. Arsenal dismissed Unai Emery a few days after Spurs binned off Pochettino, and yet they took a lot longer to appoint a successor. They eventually opted for Mikel Arteta, who has proven very popular with fans despite winning just two of his opening five matches. With that in mind, Ben, have you been encouraged by the start Arteta has made?
I think you have to be, in terms of that he's done the most important thing at Arsenal, which is he's won over the fans. He's got that sort of in his locker already. So in a way that Ljungberg strangely never did, which is sort of a weird one really. But the early signs are encouraging. I think the fact that will openly say, look, we've got problems here, and apparently he, at the halftime of the one game, he gave him a good coating off, which is good because they needed it. I think it's obviously, if you've got a £72 million winger, then you should be playing him. He's doing that a bit more. He obviously threw all four of them on the pitch together for the first time against Manchester United, which is great for the fans, but even better was that it worked. And obviously, I don't think that's a blueprint necessarily to do every time. It'd be a mistake to get lulled into the fact you can play four really good attacking players together all the time, because better teams and better managed teams are going to pick you off doing things like that. He seems to have got Xhaka on side, at least for the time being, and he seems a fan. And for all of Xhaka's sort of the baggage that goes around him, I think he's the key midfielder. I think if you put him next to Torreira, then both of them work really well together. I think you put him next to Guendouzi, both of them work together. I think if you play, as has been seen, if you play Torreira and Guendouzi together, it's chaos. So he sort of is, in a weird way, he's the Jenga piece in that set, the centre of that midfield, where if you take him away, everything else collapses. Yeah, like I said, I think it's baby steps, but I think if Arsenal are to get back to anywhere near what they were, then it is going to have to be sort of small. There aren't wide sweeping things you can do, as I'm sure we'll touch on. They haven't got any money to spend any more on players, so you got to a degree make do with what you've got already. You can see there's a sort of style of play. You can see that sort of he is trying to be a bit like Pep, which is obvious. But you see he's getting sort of the best out of players like Reece Nelson, which has got to be encouraging. I mean, it's very, very, very early days, and obviously the results aren't there, but it's good so far.
I suppose sticking with that theme, Lawrence, the kind of biggest difference at this point between Arteta and Mourinho is that with Arteta, it's kind of evident how he wants his Arsenal team to play, even when they're not necessarily playing in that way.
Yeah, that's true. I think even when they were getting smashed by Leeds in the first 45 minutes, you could tell what Arsenal were trying to do. It's just Leeds were doing it a lot better and a lot higher tempo. And it turned out Leeds had just expended all their energy within 45 minutes. So yeah, that's true. I think you can definitely see what he's trying to do. I'm really excited. Like, as a neutral fan watching on, I think it's really exciting. The Premier League needs great, thrilling Arsenal team, I think. I think the Premier League's at its best when they're playing free-flowing, attacking football. I think it'd be great if they did get back into the Champions League and were playing this kind of like really fast, high-pressure kind of style. And he seems to just have that one thing that Arsenal really have been lacking, which is not taking any nonsense from the players. So yeah, I'm really excited. I think just quietly, like Ben says, just cautiously optimistic that there's something really genuinely changing there.
They seem a united team as well now. Like, the mood at the Emirates seems a lot better. The fan base, with the exception of absolutely cutting off Arsenal fan TV at every opportunity, they seem a lot more sort of united and pulling in one direction.
Yeah.
I suppose the big serious test of their mettle now is that they've got to play Sheffield United, Chelsea, and then they return to Bournemouth in the FA Cup, and they've got to play all those matches without Aubameyang.
Yeah, that'd be difficult. And I think they'll probably, like Ben says, they'll keep slipping. They'll make mistakes, the baby steps. They'll probably lose one of those games. But like you say, it's just whether you can see what they're trying to do within that defeat, and I think we will be able to. I don't know exactly what he'll do without Aubameyang. I guess that means he doesn't have to play all four, so he can play three of them and be a little bit more solid, which will make sense for those kind of fixtures. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how he kind of approaches it in a different way. I really like the way what he's done with Ozil, sort of bringing him in off that right hand side, kind of in that pocket, and then you have Pepe right out on the wing hugging the touchline, and that just stretches the play, gives him loads of space. I think I've been really impressed with some of the little touches Ozil's shown. So hopefully he gets a bit of a running team. It's so fun to watch.
Okay, time for a quick break. When we get back, we're going to be talking about Watford, Everton, West Ham and Watford.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome back to the Indie Football Podcast. This week we are talking about the managerial changes in the Premier League this season. And perhaps the most eye-catching was Everton's decision to replace Marco Silva, former Portuguese second-tier and Greek Super League winner, with Carlo Ancelotti, who has won the Premier League, Ligue 1, the Bundesliga, Serie A, the Club World Cup and 3 Champions League titles. Ben, do you think he was a sensible appointment, or were Everton perhaps drawn a little bit magpie-like to all those sort of trophies?
I think in a weird way, it's almost a bit of both. I think he clearly is a very sparkly name, and for good reason, as you've read out his achievements. But also, I think, a bit of sense. I think that dressing room is clearly a tricky one. There's lots of difficulties there, mainly the expectations of the fans who want them to just be better, more consistent, on a more consistent basis. It can't help when the guys over the other side of Stanley Park are tearing everybody apart as well. So it's tricky. I think the Derby defeat was a bad one. I think that's probably more about the club and the neurosis they have about Liverpool than necessarily about Carlo, although he could have done more in that second half to sort of change what became clear was about to happen. He's a good manager, as has been mentioned plenty of times. He's perhaps not the manager to sort of rebuild an entire squad and club from the ground up. The time when he did that best was at Milan, and nearly 20 years ago now. Yeah. And he's been more sort of dealing with ready-made squads. But like, if you look at the players they have there, it's not a bad squad at all. They spent, I think I saw this week, well over 400 million in the last 4 years. So it's not like they haven't got quality in there. He seems to be doing a few things a bit differently. I quite like the Coleman, Sidibe wing back, sort of right centre back thing that's going on there. He needs to get Moise Kean scoring, obviously, which is big. But there's sort of, yeah, again, it's baby steps. I think, like we said with Arteta, I think perhaps even more so, if you can win the crowd at Everton, then you'll buy yourself the time you need. Yeah. Because they've got high expectations for a good reason. They spent a lot of money. They want to see a return on that straight away. It seems like they've got a couple of results that they wouldn't have got before, showing a bit of metal, which is good. But they're a little bit away yet, but I think they're sort of going in the right direction.
Tony said something really interesting last week as like a passing comment, which I'd be quite interested to get your opinion on, Lawrence, because his fear with Ancelotti is that, you know, he's this guy who's got a lot of other stuff going on in his life, and he's got all this kind of experience, and he's been around the block with all these big super clubs, and he's not going to be the man who's going to be kind of obsessing over Y-Scout at, you know, 8 p.m. on a Friday night. Do you kind of see that, or do you think that, you know, with the squad Everton have assembled incredibly expensively over the last few seasons, that they can kind of sort themselves out to a degree?
Yeah, well, I think the interesting thing about the Ancelotti appointment, and it's very, what makes it different to the other appointments in mid-season, quite often in mid-season, someone gets sacked and you hear the club say, right, we just need to strip it back to basics. We need to, you know, get someone in with some discipline, fines for late in training, all that kind of stuff. And obviously Ancelotti comes with a reputation that's very different to that. You read like what Frank Lampard says about him, and he was quite a laid back, relaxed guy at Chelsea. You know, attacking managers, just let the players play. So I suppose the question is, can Everton sort of thrive off that? And perhaps, is that a big shift from what Marco Silva was doing? I think probably it is. They've got a really talented squad there, like a squad that should be finishing top seven, top six. I think I was just checking the Premier League table. I think they're 4 points away from sixth place. So like they can go that high. And I think they've got the squad to do it. And someone like Gylfi Sigurdsson, if Ancelotti gives that kind of player lots of freedom, I think can just like, yeah, he can fly and he can sort of lead that squad to much higher things.
Everyone's kind of discussed how Arteta's more or less got a free pass when it comes to results for the rest of the season, and you know, there's this kind of understanding that Mourinho doesn't have that and has to kind of steer Spurs back into the top four. Where do you think Ancelotti kind of fits in with those kind of expectations? Do you think that Everton fans are going to be happy to kind of write the rest of the campaign off if he gets them playing well, or does he need to, you know, be continuing this promising run of results?
I think it's both, in that I think the fans will, I mean, if they lose three games in a row, they're not going to be very happy. But I think the club are all in on Ancelotti because of the money they've had to pay him, how big an appointment it is for Everton. Like, not to belittle the club in any way, but 10 years ago when he won the double at Chelsea, if you thought that 10 years later he'd be at Everton, you'd no chance. So like, they're a massive club and they deserve a big name manager, but it's still a big, big appointment for them, and they have to see it through. So almost more than any other manager we've talked about, I think he has got a complete free hit. And it's, if you read between the lines and the stuff you read about the appointment, it's fairly clear they're going to go big, big, big in the summer. Mm-hmm. And I think he doesn't take that job unless he knows they are going to spend big money again in the summer. So I think the rest of this season is sort of, is him sorting the wheat from the chaff in his squad that he already has. Which of these players can I rely on, and do I want to go forward with? Which ones need replacing? And then the summer, it'll be up to Marcel Brands to go and get the players that Carlo wants. And I think then we can properly judge him when he's got a squad that he wants playing the way he wants them to.
Okay, moving on to West Ham. They made probably one of the most unpopular managerial decisions in recent memory when they replaced Afberwald, Manuel Pellegrini with David Moyes. And yet it's been a pretty good start for Moyes. A 4-0 win over Bournemouth, a 2-0 win over Gillingham, and then a very unlucky 1-0 loss to Sheffield United. He wants to be seen as a kind of long-term proposition. Lawrence, could he be that, or is he simply a stopgap?
I think he can be a long-term proposition. He's made a good start. This is almost the flip reverse of the Everton situation, like Pellegrini going out. And Moyes is one of those managers who seems to have brought in the discipline back to basics. Players like Mark Noble seem to be performing much better. So, yeah, I think he can be a long-term solution. I suppose the question is, what are the ambitions of the club? If they're happy to just get back to being a competitive top half team, I think Moyes can do that. If their ambitions, which they say they are higher, then obviously Moyes becomes more of a stopgap, and you're actually looking for him to just stabilise, and then for someone else to come in and bring the revolution, perhaps an Arteta type character. I think he's a good enough option for now, and he's made a really good start.
One of the more entertaining transfer rumours of this week has been that Moyes apparently wants to sign Ross Barkley on loan for West Ham. Ben, do you think that's a good idea?
Well, it's potentially. I think the fact they're not alone at West Ham, in the fact they are sort of like a sort of chalk and cheese squad. It feels like you've got Andrei Yarmolenko and Manuel Lanzini and Sebastian Allaire on one side, and then you've got Mark Noble and Aaron Cresswell and Ryan Fredericks on the other. It's sort of like they're two halves of the same squad. I think there's a very similar thing at Everton, where they've sort of got half one kind of things that fit together and then another half of things that fit. And David Moyes is coming in, and you know the kind of players he's going to like. And it's no surprise that they signed Darren Randolph and they've been linked with Joe Allen. I mean, they're very Moyes signings. I think it's fine. It's just that you would have a squad that's a bit more balanced. Mm. It's just, it's going to be quite a stark change when you bring them all in at once to complement the very exciting attacking players, your Felipe Andersons. At the same time, as ever with West Ham, you've almost got to save them from themselves. And it's not, it was, you could see it straight away that they suddenly get linked with Gedson Fernandez. And in no way is that a David Moyes signing. That's a very much a David Gold, David Sullivan signing. You can see it. I think Barkley is certainly on the Moyes side of it. If you can get him going, he's a very good player. He's certainly an arm around the shoulder guy. Moyes obviously knows him very well. So potentially it could be quite an exciting signing. Whether the Chelsea let him go, I think, will be more of an indication of whether they think that Ruben Loftus-Cheek's going to be fit soon or not. Because it's sort of, they haven't got tons of options there. And I think if they let Barkley go, they're going to need to have someone ready made to replace it.
Feels very similar to when West Ham snapped up Jack Wilshere from Arsenal.
Yeah, it does.
Where it makes, it kind of, it feels like it makes sense, but it doesn't really.
You're never quite sure if they're doing something to fit the new brand with the London Stadium and all of that, or whether they actually think it's going to improve the team. And you're also not quite sure who's making the decisions. You know, is David Moyes directing this sort of stuff? I don't think he is. Like Ben said, I don't think it was a Moyes signing. So you're just always slightly confused with who's got a plan. And probably the answer is no one.
Okay, last but not least, let's move on to Watford. They have obviously made not one but two managerial changes this season. One disastrous, one extremely successful. Let's start with Sanchez Flores. Lawrence, what did you make of that plan to parachute him back in?
I didn't hate it. He had quite a good season when he was there. People said he was sacked. I think he was just kind of fell out with the owner essentially and left and obviously came back. But I think they needed a shake-up. It was clear, even at the end of last season, that things were plummeting under Javi Gracia, and we saw the FA Cup final was a disaster. Mm. And that just continued. I think they made the right decision to step in and change him, but they didn't bring anything new. They just brought an old face, and that clearly didn't change anything. Clearly, now Nigel Pearson has had a really impressive impact. He's done a few things. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about the discipline, the kind of, you know, raising the standards, banning ketchup in the canteen, all that kind of stuff that you normally hear. And there's nothing wrong with a good bit of, you know, old-fashioned British you know, discipline and leadership in that sense, which I think probably Watford needed. But he's also made tactical changes, and we talked earlier about the Mourinho asymmetric back four, and that's basically what he's done as well. And he's let Messina sort of sit at left back, and then Mariappa fly down the right wing, and what that's done is allowed Saar to just float from the right wing and be really destructive. He's pushed Decore right up alongside Deulofeu, and those changes have had really quick impacts. I think Decore's got a couple of goals and a couple of assists in three games. Saar looks really, really impressive. So I think it's not just that he's kind of his personality. I think it's also his tactical astuteness has made an impact, and they're already out of the bottom three.
Okay, brilliant. I think that's about all we've got time for. There's just enough time left for a hero and villain of the week. Ben, do you want to go for a hero?
So we're recording on Thursday, I would say, after last night, Brandon Williams, who Gary Neville says would bite an opponent's nose off to win a game, which I quite like the image of. He's been tremendous, as Rio Ferdinand noted last night. He's getting better and better and better every time he plays. It does, as ever with Manchester United, it's sort of good with bad, and it does paint the idea of giving Luke Shaw £150,000 a week about 9 months ago. It seemed very odd indeed. But yeah, Williams has been excellent, and United need, I mean, they play on the fact that they always have an academy kid in the squad, but United do feel a bit more like it when they've got academy players in the first 11 making a difference. Him and McTominay, I think, are the bright sparks from maybe a season which is not quite as good as they hoped.
And Lawrence, there's no Tony this week to slag off the Tory party, so could you potentially nominate a villain?
Yeah, we decided to go with UEFA. The story broke this morning that they want to expand the Champions League, which I think is quite a bad idea. So I was just having a look at it now.
Even though they're going to have the third competition?
Yep, along with the third competition. This is 2024, so it's still a little while away. But four extra matches, possibly even considering bringing back a second group stage, which was quite fun back in the day for a little bit. But yeah, it's just non-compatible with the ridiculous. I mean, we were talking yesterday, weren't we, about the AFCON scheduling, which is already going to cause chaos next season. In the middle of the season, Salah and Mane and all those kind of players will have to possibly miss six games. And the Champions League definitely doesn't need expanding, so UEFA.
Cool, thank you. Sadly, that is all we've got time for this week. Be sure to follow Indie Football on social media to keep up to date with everything that is going on. If you're a new listener, please subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you listen. And we'll see you next week. Goodbye.